So it's always great to be introduced as someone who's going to make you feel uncomfortable. For the next half hour, I'll be scraping my fingernails across the board and talking about chewing tinfoil. Isn't that, you've never done it, but you think about it. It's just visceral reaction. I also hate to contradict the introduction, but I'm not really a future guy. I'm much more interested in a now thing. Now, clearly, we need to know where we want to head. But my favorite line about the future is actually comes from Alan Kay, who developed some of the early work at Xerox PARC and Apple and all this other stuff. And he said the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And so one of the things that I want to spend some time talking about is when we invent the future, what are we going to develop? And I think that's a very different perspective than some folks may have. Because the idea of inventing it means that it is in your hands, that you have power. And I think all too often the conversation about what is the future of the library sits back and says, what is the future of the library? You know, what are people going to do to us? What is Google going to invent that's going to screw us up? You know, when are we going to be put out of business? Come on, tell me. And I think that it's a very sort of passive view. And I don't like the question about what is the future of the library. This is why, you know, I'm an academic. I'm sorry. I apologize in advance. But we love questions. This is what we do. As someone once said, when I was an undergraduate, I would go to a professor and ask a question. They would give me the answer. And as a graduate student, I would go to a professor, ask a question. They would say, what a great question. Right? So that's where I am. So this is a bad question. What is the future of the library? Because I would call up, someone asked me to answer that question. I would call up library directors, and I'd call up an academic library director and say, what is the future of the library? And they'd go through a half hour of, well, I can't tell you about this, and what do you mean? And then they'd say, all right, I'm an academic library director. I can't tell you about the future of public libraries because they're screwed. But in academic libraries, we're all going to be about knowledge and education and a social space. And I call up a public library director. And they would say, well, I can't tell you about academic libraries because they're screwed. But we're all going to be about knowledge, education, and a social space. And you just want to, like, take the phone and say, could you just take a moment to talk to each other? So the other thing, so I don't like that question. What question I do like is, what should be the future of libraries? That should means that we can predict and put an ideal setting and work towards it. Because ultimately what we need to develop is an agenda. An agenda comes down to tasks, and tasks tell us where to proceed and how to move forward. So what should be the future of libraries? Now I'll go even further and say I don't like the question about what is the future of libraries. So excuse me as I do a little semantic whacking on this. I really don't care what happens to the building. I care what happens to you folks. So what I'm much more interested in is what should be the future of librarians? Because ultimately, if we look at how we're going to provide service and how we're going to do this, we are the actual engines that power the organizations, that power the buildings, that power the collections that interact. And so what I'm very interested in is where are we headed as a profession? Because that's going to dictate it. I mean, when you talk about embedded librarians, when you talk about the notion of maybe in the future there'll be fewer libraries but more librarians, and say, is that a scenario that we want to go with? Where do we want to head here? So I will then make one last little attempt to bond with the audience by telling you that as I was driving through Pittsburgh and I was going over the bridge that quickly, the one with all the cars that were like parked, I mean, I'm telling you, I don't know. There's so many damn rivers around here. I also grew up in Cincinnati, and we know there's only one river that matters. Oh, all right. I left before I became a Bengals fan. It's okay. But as I was trying to, I realized that my first time to Pittsburgh was when I was 18, and I was accepted to Carnegie Mellon through their art program because there's no way I'd be academically valuable for anything else. And I threw my best friend in a truck, and we drove to all the schools I was accepted. So we went from, we drove to Pittsburgh, and then we drove up to Syracuse, and then we drove to Rochester and came back. And as we were approaching Pittsburgh, my friend goes, so where are we going? I said, we're going to Carnegie Mellon. He goes, yes, but where is Carnegie Mellon? I said, it's in Pittsburgh. He goes, no, I got that. Where in Pittsburgh is Carnegie? I said, there'll be signs. This is why we want 18-year-olds voting. You know, and so and somehow I found, like, I got to, what's the triangle? The point? and I found someone and they said, oh, it's easy. Just go up Forbes Avenue. Cha! One way. Like randomly which way that is. Yeah! All right. I'm not alone. All right. So there we go. So I'm gonna give you my conclusion because I think this is always helpful. One of the things that we concentrate on now, we've sort of learned from the communications department, is that we should write headlines. That when you give a talk, when you give a speech, when you start a meeting, what you want to do is you want to start with a headline. Give me the everything in one sentence. And if you can't put it in one sentence, then maybe you need to think on this issue some more. So, we must focus on connection management instead of collection management is my headline for the moment. And I'm even going to give you the conclusion. The conclusion, and we'll come back to this, is that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. That we are the right profession, uniquely positioned in the knowledge age. However, we won't get there focused on current trends and focused on recorded knowledge and buildings. Now, I'm going to just go ahead and tell you before we move too much further that we're going to go through a couple of levels of abstraction. So this is my little abstractometer, right? So, you know, we'll talk about things up at the 30,000 foot level and we'll get down to the gutter at some point with some of these things. But I ask you to hang with me when we fly a little high. Promise that we'll get low. So let's run into this. What I want to begin with is talking about worldview. Now, I've been on the keynote circuit, which means I have to speak 45 minutes very forcefully, very loudly, and then get the hell off the stage. We have time here, so I want to spend a little time really looking at an area that we call new librarianship, which really focuses on what should be this future? What is the foundation? And it's really grounded in the notion of a worldview. Now, many of you are familiar with a map like this. You probably had it in grade school at some point. And now, this is the interactive portion of our day. Can anyone tell me what the lines are that go like this? And the ones that go like this? And if I were walking through the jungle, would I trip over one of these lines? No. They don't exist. So what's very interesting is where those things came from, which was, you know, around the turn of the millennia, actually 2 millennia ago, sea power was very important, right? As colonies were developed in the Aegean Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, being able to move commerce and trade really involved being in a boat and going. Now, the trick was that when you first got in the boat and going in these early days, you navigated by what's called a landmark, which literally meant when you were floating on your boat, you would look on the land and see, oh, there's the cliff face I'm looking for, there's the lighthouse, there's the crooked tree, etc. And all the charts at the time were really about these landmarks. But it also meant that you could never lose sight of the land, because if you ever lost sight of it, you might as well have fallen over the edge of the earth. And no, Columbus did not discover the world was round. Aristotle figured that out a while before, right? But as we moved ahead and astronomy became important, suddenly we could figure out how north and south we were by the positions of the stars, positions of the sun, certain dates. We could figure out latitude. But we could never figure out longitude. Now, longitude is a really tough thing to figure out because the stars move in a crazy way. The moon refuses to behave. And all these navigators on these boats were going blind because they were using sextants to look at the sun. Not a good idea. And so there were these massive competitions to figure out longitude because at the time they were starting to build colonies over here in North America in the Western Hemisphere, and they would put these big boats full of treasure, send them on their way. They would throw a log over the side of the boat, see how long it took for the log to sort of go into the distance, and they would come up with what was called a dead reckoning to figure out how fast they were moving and therefore guess how far east and west. The problem with this is the reason they called it dead reckoning is that it was often crap. And they'd run into things like islands and rocks and die, and that was bad. And so France and all the major colonies put out these major X prizes to figure out how to calculate longitude. And astronomers tried it, and everyone tried it, and they all failed until this one English gentleman built a really, really good clock. And the really good clock was useful because you could know when the sun was straight ahead of you, that was noon. You could also know what noon was where you left because your clock was set where it's left. Pick an arbitrary route. Guess what? They picked Greenwich because he was English. Right? And then they could figure out longitude. Now, the trick with this is that that grid line that they then built opened up an amazing world. It suddenly, you could navigate wherever you needed to go. You could know how far north, south, east, west. You could know where you were on the globe. You could find directions back and forth. In fact, it was such a powerful concept that we use it to this day. So when I was going very slowly over the bridge that went into the tunnel, I don't know which one, my GPS was sitting there telling me, oh my God, get over to the right, right? It uses the same system of longitude and latitude. Instead of using stars, it uses satellites. And instead of using clocks with springs, it uses compressed quartz and how fast it goes. My point of all of this is that this longitude and latitude doesn't exist. It is a concept. It is a mental construction by human beings. It is a thought. And that thought, that view, that idea of the world is so powerful that it's been used for centuries. It's opened up how we see the world. Now, if you wonder what that means with how you see the world, this is the map that they use in Australia. It is not upside down. The Australian said, excuse me, north, up, why? I don't think so. Let's do it this way. How we see the world, how we understand the world is about our worldview. And so the question I have for you is, what is your worldview of librarianship? What is it that when the next gadget comes out, when someone says to blog or to Facebook or thou shalt Twitter or let's throw tags at this or let's do story hour, let's do this, what are you basing those decisions on? Is it your worldview where you say this is my value, this is what I'm doing, this is how I understand the world, or is it, I don't know, let's just try it all? Because that's worked so well for us to this point, right? How many people just got rid of the 8-track collection, right? Remember the days when we were going to carry around the library in a microfiche briefcase, right? Let's try it all. Who was it who once said that libraries are like the cemeteries of file formats of long ago, right? There, it's there. We got it. So we want to look at our worldview. And I want to give you one example of librarianship worldview that we have. And just to show you that oftentimes we don't even question it. So let's go through history. One of the things I have to do in an LIS program is to teach the history of librarianship. Right? So if you want to know your future, look to your history. Well, which history do we look towards? So this is probably a history you heard at one point. Librarianship started in the Library of Alexandria. If it didn't start there, it certainly was perfected there. Right? And it was all the world's knowledge. And then, depending on whether you're anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, anti-Christian, anti-whatever, someone burned it down. Right? I swear, you can go, hey, look, the Muslim conqueror came in, said, what's not in the Quran, burn the rest. Or it was, what's not in the, right? But the point is, all the world was lost and the Dark Ages befell us. But it was okay because happy monks were hanging out in their basements. The original Xerox machines copying text back and forth, which preserved knowledge so that when enlightenment finally came, we could look in them and say, ah, right? And then, of course, because in America and everyone knows that if the universe doesn't rotate around the earth, it certainly rotates around America. The next advancement in librarianship came with Ben, hanging out in Philadelphia where he created the public library as we know it, and life is good. Yeah, somewhat, a little bit of that. Let me give you an alternative view of this. Maybe you knew I was going there. I will start with the Library of Alexandria as well. But what you may or may not know is that the Library of Alexandria wasn't a building. It was a campus. It had multiple buildings. In fact, the buildings were built around economic development. It was one of the first economic development schemes of its day. In Alexandria, they would bring scholars from around the known world. They would put them up tax-free, and they would have them hang out. And besides having the library here, they also had this building called that was dedicated to the muses called the Musée, which is where we get the term museum, which is where they stored scrolls and materials. Now, they stored some with the scholars as well within the library, but they was just as likely to end up in the Musée. Now, My favorite story about the Library of Alexandria is that Alexandria was this major shipping port. And so every time a ship pulled in, they would send soldiers down to meet the ship. They would take all the documents they could find on the ship, take them to the library, copy them, and give the copies back to the ship. I think this is brilliant. You guys should be like on the border of Allegheny County. Whatever the car drives in, could I have your iPod, please? There you go. Thanks very much. We have all your data. Right? It was also one of the things that the librarian of the Library of Alexandria was one of the closest confidants to the rulers of Alexandria. The librarian was there helping to determine what strategy was and where to go. Librarian wasn't sitting and hanging out and making sure the scrolls were organized. They were there trying to figure out, how can we improve our military? How can we improve our economy? How can we improve civic life? And then, rather than looking at what happened when it got destroyed, and the truth is the collection existed, much of it ended up in the Islamic world. So while those monks were busy sprawling away in the basement, the Pope had a problem, which is that all his noblemen were trying to kill each other. And so rather than doing it, the Pope said, go somewhere. Right? I have a 7-year-old. I'm used to this idea. A 7-year-old and a 10-year-old. They're fighting. Go somewhere. Just do something else except for killing each other. So the Pope said, free Muslim Spain. Go! Get out of my hair! Right? So the noblemen went on their crusade, mostly with Muslim mercenaries, and they took Toledo. And what they found in Toledo was they found library after library after library. And while all the monks were busy sprawling away, one library in Alexandria held more volumes than all the volumes in France. And not only were those volumes there, they were being used for agriculture, they were being used for engineering, they were being used for architecture. And in fact, this explosion, as we'll talk about in a while, led to a renaissance within Western Europe. Now, I'll skip ahead to the United States, but instead of talking about Benjamin Franklin, who did not create the first public library, he created a subscription library in Philadelphia, I'm going to go to Dr. Pepper. Swear to God, that's his name. Dr. Pepper was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania with a rich uncle who was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And he said, for the betterment of this community, we need to create a free library open to all. And so the Free Library of Philadelphia was the first public library in Philadelphia created there. Now, with this history, what I want to show you is there's a worldview behind both of them. And how you look at your history, when you say that, as I do often, I'm in librarianship, right? We have a 2,500-year heritage. Right? We look, if we're not the oldest profession, we organize the records of the person who has had the oldest profession, right? This worldview is ingrained in it, which is from collection to scholarship. Was the Library of Alexandria about materials and artifacts and scrolls? Or was it about economic development, opportunity, knowledge, and learning? Instead of looking at the idea of dissemination, that this information was preserved, do we look at it as action? This information was put to use. This information was building cultures and societies. And instead of looking at the notion of sharing information, we look at it as a public good. These worldviews influence how we look at the future, what we do and how we do it. And oftentimes, we don't even realize that we have them. We don't realize that we enculturate people into them. Right? Ultimately, what I want to talk about is moving from a worldview where knowledge as thing to the idea of knowledge as action. Because that will have profound impacts to how we design libraries in the future. It will talk about what we do with our collections. It will talk about what we do with our services. It will talk about our focus. So I want to make that argument. And I'm going to start by giving you a mission. The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. Now we're going to walk through this ad nauseum. But I just want you to note a few things before we get further into it. The first is, this is a mission of librarians. This is a mission that I'm hoisting onto you. How many mission statements have you read, or written, that start with, the library does this, the library does that. The library does nothing but take up space and rot. You do this. right? And you say, well, Dave, come on, we met the organization, it's the Royal Library, whatever it is. That's fine. But if you look at how that seeps down, it turns into things like the library website sucks. Well, why? Because when you got it out of the library website machine, you got the wrong one? Or is it because someone put together a sucky website? Right? There's a question of personal responsibility here. The idea that it is the librarians of Allegheny County that. It is the librarians of Green Tree. Is there a Green Tree Library? I don't know. There you go. That do this, right? It is us that interface with that community. Now, this is not to say the buildings don't matter, tear down the buildings. This is not going to be that talk. This is a talk that says, take the responsibility yourself. This is something where we need to understand what our role is. The other is, notice this isn't, the mission of the library is to keep lots of stuff. The mission of the library is to accumulate lots of stuff. The mission of the library is to do something, to build knowledge, to improve society. And if you think that that's too high-flying, I think you may be in the wrong profession. All too often I see librarians that undersell ourselves. Oh, we're just librarians. We're just librarians? Who stood up to the Patriot Act? We're just librarians? Who stands up for people who don't have information access? We're just librarians? Who stands up for knowledge within a community and culture? Just librarians. We are in a noble profession, and we don't like to, we like shy away from the idea that, oh, those are, why do we shy away from nobility? Why do we shy away from Shakespearean overtones? Why do we shy away from the greatness of our own profession? We need to stop doing that quickly. We can't just wait for politicians and football coaches to give great speeches. We need to spend a little bit of time singing our own songs. So, when you look at this mission, we can break it down into pieces. We can say, well, what do you mean by mission? Well, for me, that is how to achieve a worldview, right? The worldview drives your mission. If your worldview is you are collections with people who maintain the collections, you will have one mission. If you look at it as you are people improving communities that may use collections, very different mission. What do I mean by librarians? What do I mean by improved society? What do I mean by facilitation? What do I mean by knowledge creation? What do I mean by communities at all? So I want to just spend some time going through these. And we're going to start with the most basic, which is what do I mean by knowledge creation? Okay. Here's what knowledge is not. A rock. Now that's Ayers Rock. I'm sure you all knew that. Right in Australia. Now, what I want to point out about the rock and knowledge is that knowledge is not a thing. The phrase recorded knowledge is an oxymoron. It does not exist. You cannot record knowledge. Knowledge is uniquely in our brains, human-to-human activity. All right? Until we get artificial intelligence, we're stuck with natural intelligence until we figure that out. So knowledge is in our head. What do I mean when I say it's not a rock? Well, if we look at Ayers Rock for a moment, and we send a geologist down to spend time with Ayers Rock, they will tell you how old it is, they'll tell you the geological process that formed it, they'll tell you why it's red, they'll tell you lots of stuff. If you send an anthropologist down to Ayers Rock, they'll talk about its position in Aboriginal culture, they'll talk about cultural significance, they'll talk about tourism significance. When I look at Ayers Rock, I think about the trip I took with my wife, right? It's not in the rock. The rock doesn't tell the geologist this. The rock doesn't communicate this to the anthropologist. We bring it to the rock. We bring this information to the rock. So when we talk about knowledge, it is not resident in the thing. It is what we bring to it. So when people look at the Gutenberg Bible, some people look at the Gutenberg Bible and they say, oh, this is the origin of printing. Some people look at the Gutenberg Bible and they say, this is a valuable artifact. Some people look at the Gutenberg Bible and say, this is the Word of God. And some people do all three of those at the same time. The Gutenberg Bible doesn't bring that out. We bring it to that item, to that object. Now, why does that matter? Because I told you, we're in abstract land. We'll get there. What is knowledge? Knowledge is our actions. It's how we understand the world and behave with it. And knowledge is created through conversation. Right? Now, this comes out of something called conversation theory, and let me break it down for a minute. Conversation theory says, In a conversation, building knowledge, you have conversants, the people having the conversation. Right? We're going to break these down a little bit further. They're exchanging language. They're exchanging language to develop agreements. And based on those agreements, they will hold a memory of those agreements over time. Now, this is like so high level that I'm getting a nosebleed, right? Who cares? I don't want another thing on theory. I just want to know if my budget's going up. Stop it. It has real implications. Because if you look at knowledge this way, if you buy knowledge this way, it has real implications. Let me tell you why. Start with conversants over there. So conversants, so I'm going to do the running why does this matter line down here. We'll start with conversants. Now conversants, when you think about a conversation, you think two or more people sitting having a chat. So far, so good. Now, we know they're having a chat. They don't necessarily have to be standing right next to each other to have a chat. They can do it via email. They can do it via web conferencing. They can do it at a distance. So it's two people having interchanges back and forth. Okay. Can it be three people? Sure. Can it be four? Sure. Can we talk then about the idea of these group of people having a conversation with these group of people? Sure. The library having a conversation with a vendor. How much are you going to charge me today? Right? The U.S. having a conversation with Russia. The society having a conversation with society. So we can aggregate up. If we can aggregate up with conversants, we can also go down. Now, what do I mean by that? Can you have a conversation with yourself? And if you're a reference librarian, you know the answer is yes. And you know you don't want them doing it in front of your reference desk anymore. But if at any point during this talk you vent yourself going, why am I here? What did he just say? Does he really believe that? Who are you talking to? Right? If you woke up this morning and said, well, if I take the bridge, it's going to be slow. If I take this way and get bagels, I'll go this way. Who are you talking to? You know, when I got up and said, does this court coat make me look fat? No, your fat makes you look fat, Dave. Right? Who am I talking to? Right? So we can have internal conversations. Now, why does this matter? This matters that when you talk about reading, reading is a conversation. But with whom? It is not with the book. The book is dead tree. You're not having a conversation with a book. This is why I hate the idea of social software within our catalogs. Why? Because catalogs aren't social. It's not like the books hang around at night going, so, how was your day? Pretty good. Do you see that idiot talking to me? Oh, man, did you see his sloppy fingers turning my pages? What a pain in the butt, right? Books don't talk. You're not having a conversation with the author. If you're reading Shakespeare going, Shakespeare, why did you make Hamlet such an idiot, right? Bill doesn't go, well, what I was thinking was, right? You don't have this, right? We're having a conversation with ourselves. We can literally split our heads in two and debate items. This is what's uniquely human. We can actually contradict ourselves. I mean, have you ever been walking down the street where you've literally done this? Right? It's not Tourette's. You're having an internal debate and your legs are getting in the way. Right? This idea of reading is conversation. So we're learning. And I also want to be really clear before I go much further. When I talk about knowledge creation, people automatically say, oh, that's textbooks and that's nonfiction and that's encyclopedia. No! It's all reading. It's all media production. Right? If you watch New Jersey Housewives and you sit there and you go, I'm a bad person for watching this, you're learning about yourself. Things you may not be happy to know about yourself, but you're learning about yourself, right? Catcher in the Rye, My Name is Asher Lev. These are books that teach us what it is to be human, what it is to be a woman, what it is to be a man, what it is to be, etc. So it's learning, it's knowledge, and it's an internal conversation. Now, why does this matter? Why this matters is that learning is participatory. So if we talk about our community's learning, we talk about our role in education, if we talk about knowledge development, what it means is those people who are learning are part of the process. That's why I hate the word customer. Libraries don't have customers. Libraries don't have consumers. I hate the word patron, too, by the way. Patron sounds like, you know, they should be in a 16th century salon with some rich guy shoveling money at them. Oh, thank you. Well, patron, I'll make a painting for you, right? Dear God. I like the word that Joan Fry Williams came up with. Joan Fry Williams was part of consulting with the library and working on the strategic plan, and they came to this part. Call them, right? Besides, oh, God, here they come, right? And she had a radical idea, which is she actually left the room, walked into the library, and asked them. And their answer overwhelmingly was, member. I'm a member. And what's interesting is, you say, oh, sure, they want to be members. But they had, like, really good things. They said, all right, one, I pay dues. It's called taxes. Two, when I come here, you give me a card. I'm a member. I have privileges. I don't have privileges. What I love about the word member is it implies ownership, that they are part of, that they are a co-equal thing. Because let's face it, if libraries were just librarians and books, even we would be bored with it after a while. We need those crazy idiots to come in and mess things up. It gives us something to do during the day. But that means that a library is not you plus stuff. A library is the community plus you. That you are part of that community. But it also means that there's give and take. When you have a conversation, when you're learning, you have to give over control. Right? In a reference interview, we all know what a bad reference interview looks like, right? So what do you need? You need a book? Is this the book? You want that book? Here's the book. You would take this book. Read that book. Right? And never taking a breath to say, oh, that wasn't the book. Right? Or you're the reference stalker. Have you seen these folks? Right? This is where, you know, you get a really good question. They go, well, you could read this book. Oh, great. Thanks. That's just what I need. Or you could read this book. Well, no, I really just need one. Or you could read this book. No. Really, I'm fine with just that one resource. Well, I got some other ones. No, really. I've got, and you're like chasing them out the door, throwing encyclopedias at their head, right? I have a reference stalker online. Every time I like pose a rhetorical question on Twitter, I get a phone call. I'm like, boy, is it nice out today. Well, can I answer that question for you? Go away! You know? So the idea here is that when we talk about being in the knowledge business and knowledge, we have to be talking about being in a partnership with the people learning. And they're in control. You're also in control. We'll come back to that in a minute. Language. Let's talk about language for a minute, which is these conversants are exchanging language back and forth. So think about for a moment when the library sits and negotiates with a vendor, when you're in acquisitions and you're negotiating with a source, right? There's language that goes back and forth. Now, that language can be very, very specialized. So the result may be a contract in legalese that only they can read. Right? So what do we do as librarians? We reach for the one that's 30 years old and say, that again, because I don't think I got sued on it. Try it again, right? So language comes in sort of two shapes. Language comes in, right now this is to impress your friends at the dinner party, L0 and L1. L0 is negotiation language. It's when you sit and you go, are we going to speak English? Are we going to talk about this topic? In the reference interview, it's framing stuff. Right, you do this all the time, probably around these tables. If you're random, where are you from? Oh, you're from there. Did you know so-and-so? We're setting and establishing this line of communication. And once we get past that, we move to something called L1. L1 is where we actually pass content back and forth. Right, so this is when we start talking specialized. This is when we go into library talk. I love it when librarians, I have library students. I teach first-year library students, which is the best day of my week. And I come in and they're most intimidated by technology. I don't know if I'm going to know enough technology. I'm not going to know what an HTML is. God help me, what RSS is. Ah, RDA, what's RDA? And it's like, run away. And I sit there and go, you're going to be librarians. You can put every technologist to shame for three-letter acronyms. Right? MARC. Right? RDA. AACR2. We can just keep going, right? We are in Allegheny. We're not in the Allegheny County Library Association. No, we're in the ALCA, right? I went to one group, Western New York Library Council, Winnie Lurk, and they actually had, they pronounced every letter, by God. It was in there, they're Winnie Lurk, you know? We have so many acronyms that we just don't know what to do with ourselves. We just, and if you use language, library language in normal parlance, people walk away. You know, if you talk about catalogs anywhere else in the world, people think it's what you're buying a sweater from. So what do we put on the front end of our websites? Catalog. Cool. You do some shopping. And what's next? Adult services, that they're not getting what they want when they click adult services. There was a great comment. The Ann Arbor District Library put out comments, what can we do better? And the one comment's response was, more pie and prostitutes. Fundraising. I never thought about that, right? Now, why does language matter? because systems must support multiple expert languages. What I'm trying to say is that library has language. Your communities have their own languages. I went like around the block to get dinner last night, and it was a Penguins game. And there was language going on there, and I don't mean the four-letter kind, but the language, you know, there's a Pittsburgh language that I clearly don't have, right? There's a Syracuse language, which you don't want. But, you know, who has like a serious, serious hobby? You know, serious hobby. I'm not talking quilting, scrapbooking. Come on, I'll wait. You quilt? All right. Tell me something in quilt language that I will have no idea what you just said. Quarter-inch seam allowance. No clue. Right? Someone else. Come on, this is fun. Yes?
Genealogy.
Give me a genealogy language I have no clue about.
Dan and Toffel.
Clearly you have succeeded. My point of this is that there's not one L1 language, right? The quilters have theirs, the genealogists have theirs, the librarians have theirs. Now, look at the systems that we build. Look at your catalog. We do study after study about how people use catalogs. You know what we find? We find that when we look at members' use of catalog, they might as well just shoot themselves in the head and fall on the keyboard for the kind of results they get back. Right? These are the people who come in from high school and they have to do a report on the state of education. So they go up and they put in education and wonder why they didn't find their report already written for them. Right? But when you look at librarians' use of catalogs, you guys rock these catalogs. I mean, this is why you keep buying them, because they make you look so damn good. Right? I mean, you can do laser light shows with the MARC record. It's amazing. Faceted searching, and I can do subtext searching, and I can do approximate searching. I'll try that. Right? I mean, you're the only people in the world who know what a tilde does in Google. I just want to say that right out flat. All right? So this multiple languages. Now, the reason one works and the other doesn't is because we have built L1 systems. We have built systems based on our language and sort of assume people can come to it. Now, this isn't your fault. It's Dewey's fault, right? Melville Dewey, hanging out in a church in upstate New York, had a vision one day that the world could be divided into 10 and said, "I got it. Let's go with that." The idea of the universalist, I mean, we can pick on Cutter, we can pick on Ranganathan tried it. We can pick on the people who said we can come up with a universal way of organizing the world. And what the answer was, we can come up with our own L1 language. And if everyone would learn our L1 language, we can do really cool things. And you guys are the result of that. Your library science education, your working in libraries are the fact, a testament to how well you can do it if everyone speaks the same language. We just forgot to tell other people to do it. Right? No one is born speaking Boolean. You people are mutants. If you know what a Zor is, you might be a librarian. It's like the redneck thing, right? All right. So I want to give you an example of a system that actually supports multiple L1s. It's not Google. Google either supports L0, throw in education and we'll do our best guess, or they support L1, which is you do dialogue searching. Isn't anyone else find it hilarious that we're doing dialogue searching in Google and it still works? Right? It's Facebook. Think about Facebook for a moment. Facebook is a stupid system. Facebook, besides the idea of places where you can check your friends in at strip clubs. Not that I'd be there. Facebook does like three things. Violate your privacy. No, it it provides you a wall, it manages your friends, and it lets you add things. That's all Facebook does. So if you say, no, my Facebook lets me be a farmer, and you know who you are, Farmville people. The killer application of the 21st century is farming. You say, well, it also lets me do, you know, am I a millennial and who's hot and who's not and where have I been and laugh out loud kitties and all this other stuff. That's not Facebook. Facebook lets you add those modules in. But the result of that, by adding your friends and adding this module, when you look at that Facebook page, it's you. It's your L1. And if you look at my Facebook page, you may have no idea what that looks like. You may not understand it, but they can both coexist within the system. Now, when we used to build our libraries around every book had to go one place and we could only put one card in the card catalog, L1, one L1 made sense. Now, we can put thousands of them in the catalog. Now, before the catalogers freak out and talk about cleanliness of MARC records and not adding noise, as we speak, there are thousands and thousands of simultaneous conversations going on in this room. Thousands of them. But they're not interfering with this one. I'm doing that on my own. But you can tune into them if you have the right technology. They're radio waves, right? So you can tune into your phone call when you're driving down the road. You can tune into a station that you want. You can co-locate them together. And they don't interfere with each other. Well, if you look at our catalogs, at our integrated library systems, why do we assume we can't do the same thing? Why not put in multiple L1s? Here's the quilter's view of the catalog. Here's the genealogist's view of the catalog. Here's Dave's view of the catalog. The holy grail of catalogs is more like this. When you find a book, you say, more like this. Well, right now, how do you determine it? The answer is badly. And you normally do it by, well, if you look at Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, more like this. Well, clearly that's more Harry Potter. Right? But if you've done a catalog search, you get like Harry Potter Lego creator, you get J.K. Rowling stuff, it just, right? Because we don't know those connections and collections. Right? More like this, for me, is this complete encyclopedia of Star Wars vehicles and the DK Lego series. Why? Because when my now 10-year-old son was learning to read at 6 years old, those were the books we read together. So why can't I put those together in my catalog? Not that it has to be in your way. If you don't want to see it, go Dewey. Go genealogy view. Whatever. Right? So, systems must now support multiple expert languages, not just Dewey. Right? So language matters. When we look at agreements, what's an agreement? An agreement is, we're going to agree on this. It's not a fact. It can be a fact, but it can also be, it's a nice day out today. No, it's not. I'm probably dealing with a kidney stone. I don't care if the sun's out at all. Really. I just want to know how close I am to pharmaceuticals. Right. Nice days for me are when I don't have a kidney stone. Right. So the idea here of an agreement is something that we believe in, something that we understand. And the most important agreement you can reach is agreeing not to agree. Because when you have a conversation, as I hope we will have, is when you go back and forth, yeah, Dave, I don't agree with you on that. And we can start talking about this issue. And at the end of the day, we can either say, now we agree on this, or, you know, we're never going to agree on this. And then determine, is that going to stop the whole conversation, or can we move to the next part of the conversation? So these agreements are, what did we get out of this? Right? I'm trying right now through language to get you to agree to certain things like what is knowledge and a rock is not knowledge and all this other stuff. Now, what's important is that agreements lead to shared understandings. How these books are organized, what this book means. Why do you have, do you guys do the, everyone reads the same book community thing? I'm sure there's a better term for that. One book. That is much better, actually. Yes, thank you. Why? Well, the hope of that program is to build a larger community understanding that if you all start from the same text, you'll end it. So what was the last one book? Oh. A Lesson Before Dying. All right. Walk in the Woods. All right. These are always happy and upbeat books, right? What's amazing is when you have discussions around these books, are they the same conversations? No, they can be radically different conversations. But you're coming together. In Syracuse, and I'm sure Pittsburgh never has this problem, we have the triannual youth violence conversation. Youth violence is up. We got to fix it. Now, what's amazing about it, besides it's every 3 years, we're suddenly surprised it comes back, is the idea that when you sit down and you ask, why do we have this youth violence issue? Some people say, economics. There's not enough economic opportunity. Some people say not enough school or parental involvement. Some people will talk about bad policing. Some people will talk about racial politics. Some people will talk about housing. Part of what a librarian can be doing is seeking, or can we come to some common agreements on these that we can address? Because part of facilitating, as we'll get to, is what to do. Now, last one is memory. And for memory, you need to understand that memory is not like your library. Memory is relational. Memory holds these agreements, but it holds them connected together. And my connections between my agreements and your connections between those agreements can be radically different. And I'm going to show you two quick examples. First, we're going to start with a word game. Back to participation mode. I'm going to give you a word, and I want you to think what it means. Run. How many people thought jogging, physical activity? How many people thought operate as in to run a business? Anyone think of streaking as in the paint ran? All right. What else? I'm just kidding. Programming, nylons, right? Okay.
Baseball,
right. Mining, all right. Another word. Bank. How many people thought financial institution? How many people thought the thing on the side of a river? How many people thought to put aside for later? I banked this. Okay. Last one. I'm just going to go ahead and say you probably did not laugh because it was Omnimedia Group or the Omnipresent Mom Group or whatever it is. Right? It's, oh, my God. And it's got to be said that way, too. Oh, my God. Right? I'll even go further that I bet you even think about one of two specific technologies. You either thought of texting or you thought of instant messaging. Right? Now, what's going on here? Why is it that run is all over the place and bank is all over the place, but oh, my God, is so, oh, my God. Right? Your brain holds these concepts of what is run, what is bank, in all of these myriad of connections. And what's amazing about them is your brain, when given very little stimulus, picks one randomly, right? Run. You run into run so many places that when I say, what's it mean? You just sort of go, that one, right? But when you hear the other ones, baseball, you go, oh, yeah, right? With, oh, my God, there are very few connections, but they're very strong, right? My point of all this, you can scaffold them together. For example, if there's a run on the bank, oh, my God, right? So we have these ideas, and they're linked together. Right? Now, if this is how we think, and it is how we think, right? Have you ever been to the point where you, like, started a conversation and you gave someone the last line of the conversation and forgot to fill in the middle part of that conversation? Right? Or how did you get there? Well, you asked me about this, which reminded me when I was in Syracuse for this, which took me back to eating a hot dog. And so when I ate the hot dog, I thought about mustard. And mustard, you should never have mustard on a hamburger because it hurts. And hurting, well, I got a kidney stone. Right? So, you... But that's how our brains work. This is a great thing. This is why you can never ask a user what they did. Right? When they call up, when they come to the reference desk, or they call up the help desk, it's broken. Well, what did you do? They will now lie to you. They don't know that they're lying to you, but they will lie to you. Human beings will always recreate past activities so they seem logical. Your catalog's not working. Well, what did you do? Well, I tried searching on this term, and then I tried searching on that term, and I couldn't find it. But in fact, what did you do? Well, I tried searching this term, and I tripped over the terminal, and it broke. Right? We never say, this is what we do. Now, I want to give you one more example of connections and how it impacts libraries. James Burke. James Burke, one of my favorite historian broadcasters, did Day of the Universe Change, Connections 1, 2, and 3, some books so you can sort of skip. But he talks about, for example, I mentioned those libraries in Toledo. So what happens when people run into Toledo and they find these massive, massive libraries? Well, what they begin doing is translating the text. In fact, they bring in Jewish scholars to translate from the Arabic into Latin. And suddenly they're finding all these ancient Greek texts and sometimes Roman versions of those Greek texts. And they're finding this brand new knowledge, like little things like, oh, by the way, we invented zero while you were out. Right? Well, all these texts find their way to the noblemen, primarily of Italy's city-states, and the noblemen realize that if they can bring Justinian's law, if they can bring this economics and business, they can actually increase their wealth and increase their power. So they begin hiring these translators and scholars to come and teach them about the new texts. And instead of doing it one-on-one, they eventually realize, you know, we're all hiring the same tutor. Why don't we just build a building, invite the tutor in, we'll pay him a group salary? Well, this led to the earliest universities. And what's interesting is this model of the students paying the instructors is a model that persisted up until the turn of the 20th, from the 19th to the 20th century, when even medical schools were this way. In like the year 1900, the president of Harvard said, our medical students should pass a written exam in order to become doctors. And all the instructors being paid by the students said, you can't do that because they're illiterate and they can't pass. Right? So Johns Hopkins says this is not working out well for us, and they invent a new system of tuition, where now students pay tuition and the organization hires, controls, and develops the staff, which has led to the modern university system. So once again, quarreling noblemen that the Pope had to get rid of leads to my job. Right? Now that is not a linear connection. Right? It's not causal. Nowhere when the Crusaders were walking in Toledo, they go, Fort Dave and Kingdom, right? They don't do that. But a lot of interesting stuff can be found in this way. If we talk about browsing and the wonders of browsing. I was looking for this Danielle Steele book and I happened upon Faulkner, whatever it is, right? We find these serendipitous connections which are amazing to us. New ideas come out of left field. I don't know about you, but all my good ideas come in the shower. I don't know. But do your systems support that? Does your library support that? Do you look at this creative act? Do you provide people with multiple connections? So I mentioned before the idea that we need to move from collection development to connection development. We need to move from items to relationships. Your catalogs, your system, cataloging in general is built around the idea of an item. You have a book, you have a DVD, you have something, we attach metadata to it. We'll find it again, go! Right? And one of the things that we'd look at is the idea of tagging. Right? So let's tag in this so people can come and tag our books. I think tagging sucks. I'll tell you why tagging sucks. Tagging sucks because if you sit down, if I pick something random like this picture in the middle of your table and I say, come up with 10 tags to that, and one of them can't be picture. Actually, go ahead, use picture because that can be fun. Show it to someone outside of this room and figure out if they can what you were describing. Better yet, hide the list on yourself and come across it in 6 months and try and figure out what you were saying. You've all seen, you've run across the notes from a meeting and you look at this meeting, it's like, chartreuse. You know, you take these notes which mean something in the moment. Well, that's what tagging's like. So when you get something like brother, and you tag as items. Now, it turns out, because, remember the run, all that stuff? Because our language is socially developed, this will work pretty well. If you go search brother in Flickr, you'll find lots of pictures of boys and men. If you search brother, by the way, Google, image search, you'll find sewing machines, printers, Undercover Brother, an excellent film. You'll find Big Brother. You'll find all these kinds of brothers because it doesn't have enough connective tissue. Imagine instead of tagging individual things, you tag relationships. This means something radically different than the previous tag, and I haven't changed it. Instead, I've tagged, these two are brothers. These two are brothers. Now imagine in your catalog, instead of describing items, you described connections. So take something like Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Pick it up again. Can I, from your catalog, easily find the other books in the series? Don't lie. And if I did, is it because you put in a fix? Right? If you look at this, if you look at Amazon is miles and miles talking about, say, the Clip series in Twilight, right? I use Amazon too. How many people search for a book in Amazon? And then search in your catalog to see if you got it. Why? Because it's very rich in text. But what's interesting is Amazon actually has the same problem we do. Which is, I was looking for books on children's healthy sleep habits. Because when you're a new parent, you realize if they don't develop healthy sleep habits, you're going to be unhealthy. Or you're going to make that kid unhealthy. Right? And there's interesting because they showed two books, right? So if you've done the parenting thing, you know that there are two approaches for healthy sleep habits. One, take that baby in your arms and make them just, they have to be 21 before they can leave that family bed and just comfort them and soothe them forever. And the other one, which is the one I did, is kick them out, let them cry all night, they won't do it tomorrow. Right? It's like the shit my dad said approach. Now, if you go into Amazon, you will find people who bought this book also tended to buy this book, even though they are completely contradictory in their approaches. Right? Why? Because they're both about sleep habits book. If you look at the comments about the Harry Potters, you'll see comments like, J.K. Rowling's a brilliant author. I can't believe the stuff that she just seemed to throw in book one suddenly became very important in book six. Are they talking about book one or are they talking about book six? Or are they talking about the series? So if you allow comments, if you allow readers' comments, do you allow them on the series? Do you allow them, once again, if you like Harry Potter, you'll also like Lego books, and you'll like you'll like Star Wars stuff. Right? Relationships matter. It matters very much when you're designing systems. Right now, libraries really look at themselves as collections of collections. Right? We have all these heterogeneous collections, and we manage them. So you get the idea that we have databases over here. What I love about databases is if you're truly, truly successful, you get lots of money, and you buy lots of databases, which leads to greater confusion by the user, right? Why can't there just be one? I used to run the ERIC database, right? Bibliographic Database on Education Materials. And I would get regular emails that would be, why don't you have stuff on asphalt and aardvarks? Because we don't teach them that much, right? So we get databases. We get repositories. We get our digital library. We get our catalog. We have all these collections, right? Now, this leads to some interesting problems. For example, how many of you on your website have the single search box? Because we all know this. Come on. No? Really? No one? Right? Click here. We'll search for it. Right? Because we all know that's what we're supposed to do because Google does it. This is a lot like when suddenly, in 1996, we all had to have 13 categories on our own page because that's what Yahoo did. Why doesn't it work? We all want it to be like Google, but it doesn't. Why not? Well, there's a reason. Google is a collection of heterogeneous stuff. Google's a collection of websites. Now, the websites can be very varied, but they're websites, right? We have the kitchen sink, right? We have apps and books and CDs and chat transcripts and audio and database and all this other stuff, right? But Google has something that we don't have, which is Google has topological information. That's all to say that Google knows that these pages are linked somehow. So Google's great advance was that when they built their index, because you may be around long enough to remember AltaVista before, which was the bee's knees of search engines, until Google blew it away. Why? Because AltaVista was based on the old way we search documents, which we still do, which is it looked at the words in documents. Google looked at words and documents, but it looked at it as solely as connectors between these connection information. So they developed PageRank. If this page is the most pointed to page, it's probably going to be the best for you. It turns out that popularity, linked to-ness, is a great surrogate for all things like relevance and popularity and all. Not perfect. Search for apples. If you want to go pick apples, don't search for Apple, because you'll know how to buy an Apple computer. Right? You can't find stuff on the fruit until page 59, right? So it's fallible. But the point is, they're searching a cohesive document, we're not. That's why this approach will always fail. This approach of the single search box will always fail. It will never be as good. Now, what if instead of looking at the library as a collection of collections, we look at it as a collection of members' collections? Now, what do I mean? Well, this user may point to books they like, documents they read, their tags, their materials. And they might put the relationship within them. Now, really interesting idea, they may point to their own stuff. So, quick question. Is your library for the people or of the people? What do I mean? So, Ann Arbor District Library. Patron comes in. Member comes in. Careful, Dave. Says to the librarian, I can search for a book and you can tell me if it's any of your branches. I got books in my house. I'm willing to lend them. Can I put my books in your catalog? So when a book comes up and says, I need to request this book and it's going to be shipped to you in 2 days, I'm perfectly willing to, within 2 days, bring in the book. Now, if you look at that as truly bizarre, you're for the people. It's your collection that you're serving the people. If you look at yourself as of the people, that's part of the community collection. And if they're willing to do it, it makes perfect sense to share their stuff. So, if we talk about members, a collection of collections, we can really tap into what our members are doing, their materials, their expertise, their connections. If we spend as much time managing, caretaking, organizing, dusting our collections, if we took as much time doing that to maintain our communities, imagine what we would come up with. Don't go to the weeding question, because it'd be interesting to weed our communities, but we're not there yet. Now, how could they build these kind of connections? Well, think about reference for a moment. When someone comes in to ask a reference question, first of all, they have to have the guts to come in. Secondly, they have to have the guts to come up to a desk, if they can find it. And then you have this one-on-one interaction. Imagine instead you sat them at a table and they began organizing materials. So I want to show you, when we looked at, I worked with OCLC to redesign Question Point. Hasn't happened yet, but someday it will. And we came up with the following interface to replace their virtual reference. So this is a virtual reference interface. And that's it. Bless you. Alright, to be quite honest, that's it. That's the interface. So the idea is that someone sits there at this table and they begin organizing their stuff. So I'm driving and I hear this Gwen Stefani song, Rich Girl, and I go, I've heard that somewhere before. Where have I heard that song before? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and do a quick search for Rich Girl. I'm going to say, oh, there it is. I'm going to drag that in. And then, just in case you're wondering what I'm talking about. All right. So I've heard somewhere before, Dave says. Now, I can click on it, and I can get all the stuff you would normally expect to get. I can say, oh, it's by this artist, you know, it's typical metadata, and I can create a connection. This came from there. That's fine. But it's still not what I need. It's not telling me where I've heard this before. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call my buddy in. So Jeff, who knows a lot about this stuff, I'm going to see if he's online. He is. I'm going to go into a quick chat environment. Hey, Jeff, do you know where I can find the lyrics of this song? Jeff's going to do a search, same search that I have. We're doing this together because virtual reference right now is user sits on one end, librarian has the better interface with more power that can cut people off, right? It's the equivalent of the high desk, right? I mean, why did we invent reference desks that have to be this high? Let's be honest. Either so we can do this, or we can do this, right? So here we have the same tools. So he's going to search. He says, you know what? I found an existing, we call this scape, like a landscape. I'm going to bring that in. So he attaches it. Now, it has the lyrics to it, so I can look at the lyrics, but this is also, someone's taken the time to sort of caretake this. So they've taken some of the lyrics, in my Galliano gown, I get me four Hayuka girls to uh-huh, see Stefani and her lamb, I rocked a, yeah, anyway. And you can follow that up. Like, for example, I get me four Hayuka girls to uh-huh, what? Well, it turns out, these are her backup dancers, and they're named after a fashionable subway stop in Tokyo, in case you were wondering. And so I can see all these connections. Once again, nonlinear, not like this is in your music collection. I'm building these connections. But this still is not getting me where I need to go. Cool, but I know I've heard something before. I'm going to go back up, and now I'm going to bring in the heavy guns. I'm going to invite a librarian in. So I'm going to bring my librarian in, and I'm going to say, hi, do you know if this is a remake? And the librarian goes, well, actually, it's a remake from Fiddler on the Roof. Duh. That's, how many people do that? When you're answering a reference question, you always end a sentence in duh, but you never say it out loud. Right? And so with simple tools, I'll go ahead and add the information. And so with simple tools, they can go ahead and they can create this nice little scape, this nice little connection. Right? And then we're all happy, happy. And so we all sign off. Now, Jeff Pinka's driving home. We've left this open. And he hears another song, gets home, logs on, says, you're not going to believe this, but she did another one. Right? There's not enough yodeling in pop music today. Anyway. And so now he can take that and he can add additional information and we can be working on this together. Now, remember when I talked about the youth violence thing? Imagine getting people together where they said, here's a resource, here's a book, here are economic issues. No, I think they're about policing issues. No, I think they're about after-school opportunity issues. And we can draw connections, agrees, disagrees. And now we're creating this connection. So what's happening on the back end of this system is that we have all of these items, the music, the people, the discussion, the resources, but we have the connections between them. So by giving people better tools to learn with, to come in to the library, not to consume information, but to produce knowledge, to help synthesize it together, we can take it and turn it into better search engines. Because now we have the topology information. Now we begin to capture how these people see these things as connected. What do they check out on a regular basis? Do these books get checked out together? Do we link circulation data to our catalogs? That kind of thing. So implications of knowledge. Knowledge is created through conversation. If you are in the knowledge business, you are in the conversation business. And I would argue that librarians are in the knowledge business. You're not in the book museum business. And to say you're in the information business is just, if anyone could please give me a quick definition of information. I have a PhD in the topic, and I couldn't give you a quick definition of information. It's nebulous. What is it? Knowledge is that we act upon. Knowledge is how we behave on a regular basis. It's how we understand the world. It is our worldview. Conversations have shared ownership. And knowledge is an act of creation, not absorption. You can't take a 3-year-old into the stacks, leave them for 2 weeks, and come back and expect them to read. If they did, it's because a librarian took pity on them and helped teach them. Right? When technology was new to schools, people were like, oh, we don't need computers in schools. We have books. And books, you don't need to learn how to use a book. You don't need to take book training. And I say, excuse me, what is the first 6 years of formal education other than teaching them how to read? Books are an amazingly difficult interface. The language conditions, decoding, understanding, putting in social context, interpretation, that is an amazing thing that we devote an enormous amount of our gross domestic product to produce people who can use that interface. Right? But we need to invest in tools of production over artifacts. Can someone come into your library and write their own book? Can they podcast? Can they come in and produce music? Can they come into your library and produce their next invention? Can they start their business there? Can they do something other than absorb? If you're in the knowledge business, you need to give them opportunities to do something other than check out. So, that's mission, that's knowledge. What do I mean by facilitate knowledge creation? So, all right, Dave, fine, this is how people learn. That's a teacher's problem. That's a professor's problem. What does a librarian do in this? Well, a librarian has a very different role than a formal teacher. We do education. We do teaching. We do teaching every time we create a catalog record. So what does it mean to facilitate? Well, let's talk about 4 major means of facilitation. I'll do this relatively quickly. Access is one means of facilitation. If people develop knowledge through conversations, we as librarians can facilitate access to other conversations and resources to enrich that conversation. This is no great shakes. We know this. This is what we do. If you look at the budgets of your organizations, a huge amount of it goes to access issues. Cataloging, acquisitions, shelving, circulation. But access is insufficient. That three-year-old in the stacks does not learn. We need to also talk about knowledge. Knowledge is the basic understanding what they need to know before they can engage it. So, I need to learn about topic X. Oh, you can learn. There's an online discussion about that. I need access to it. We have public computer terminals. It's in Spanish and I don't speak Spanish. We need to teach you how to speak Spanish. Or it's a computer conversation. What's this mouse thing? We need to teach basic computer literacy. Access is insufficient. We need knowledge. So I know it's there. I know how to get to it. But do I feel safe in doing it? Librarians provide safe environments. Those can be safe physical environments. Right? How many people? You know the after-school kids. You know the latchkey kids. You know the folks who come there because it's a safe place to be. Right? But safety also works to intellectual safety. Right? I know if I look at this stuff, no one's going to be looking at my records later. No one's going to be staring over my shoulder. So a certain public library had a problem where they had open access terminals. And what happened was, after a while, the police started coming in every day and hanging out at the open access terminal, looking over everyone's shoulders. Librarian said, hi, can we help you? And they said, well, we know there are sex offenders and pedophiles in this area that are registered. We're just here to make sure that they don't use these terminals to access the wrong stuff. So what do you do in this case? The patrons who weren't pedophiles were looking at this information And they felt that this was unsafe. They felt a freezing effect. The librarians actually eventually decided to filter the systems because they said, look, there's now no way they can access this type of material on these systems. You can go now. Even they know they were limiting access to some material for their patrons, they were overall providing greater access and a safer environment for them to do it in. I don't want to be on one side or the other of that conversation, but that's an environment question. Won't go there. The other is motivation, which is, okay, I know that conversation exists. I know how to get to the conversation. I feel safe in that conversation, but do I even care? Right? So how many people are on a committee that has lasted longer than 50 years? What's that? Anyone part of ALA? Anyone part of a collection development committee? Has it existed for over 50 years? Right? And how many people feel like you had to be there for all 50 years of it? Right? Because somewhere on that committee will be the historian. The historian, you can tell them because they're the ones who always start with, what you need to remember is. Right? We would like to set up a blog for the library. Well, what you need to remember is in 1932 we tried blogging and it didn't work. In 1932 we did it with slate tablets and we hung them in front of the library and people could write on them and it would rain and blogging sucks. Like, yeah, right? That's not a safe environment, right? You have all been in workplaces where people have created unsafe environments. I'm a professor. I know I've sometimes created environments where students feel unsafe. Right? If you've ever asked the question, well, Professor Lankus, I don't know if that's true. And the professor comes back, well, I'm sorry. It's only got my PhD and 30 years of research behind that one. But if you don't think it's true, then this is not creating a safe environment. And it's also not motivating people. But what's interesting about motivation is intrinsic and extrinsic. Where does the reward come from? Intrinsic means I get a personal reward from it. Librarians rock with intrinsic motivation. You all have a story about the person who found the perfect book. Usually they're young, and normally they come back and, I found the perfect book, and they love it, and that's great. They were intrinsically motivated. But there's another kind of motivation, which is extrinsic. And we suck at that. Now you say, well, we don't deal with that. People come into the library and say, how many people have the fifth grader, the third grader, where they had to come to the library to work on paper X, Y, or Z? Right? It's like, I need a book. Which one? I don't care. Right? We need to learn about motivating people. We need to learn about how they get motivated, how they learn about things. How can we force use of the library? Now people go, force use of the library? Force use of the library. Enforced use of library by Dave Lankus. You all are part of some municipality, yes? These municipalities are in large parts information organizations, are they not? They generate information through minutes, tax rolls, data, surveys, housing information, zoning laws, right? How many of you organize that information for your communities? And they said, library? Right? And you said, right, you're the book people. You're the Danielle Steele free DVD people. Right? No! We're the make sure that we can see this to ensure democracy people, and we're coming over with our public access requests, right? This idea of talking about legislation that talks about use of these information, how do we do it? So, access. Provide meeting rooms, right? We all provide meeting rooms or space. Providing sufficient bandwidth of information. Collection of long-term and unique resources. Provision of long-term storage. Knowledge, training and education, mentoring, access to experts, environment, free and open access, safety and acceptable use, community norms, motivation, recognizing the efforts of people. Libraries have two identities within them. There is librarian and there is not librarian. Right? The mayor could come in and look at the record for his own book or her own book and say, you misspelled my name. And what would you do? Well, we'll talk to the librarian who can fix that system. Right? You're not us. Don't you have people that know your collections better than you do? Don't you have people that you should just say, here's a shelf, you handle it. Manga collection, local genealogy society, local historical society. This is your information. You organize the shelves. You organize it. You put it there. Oh, no, but they don't cost money to catalog it. Don't catalog it. But then people might steal it. That's their problem. But what if it gets out of order? That's their problem. If you're willing to provide the space and they're willing to provide the manpower, that seems like a perfect connection to me. So, means of facilitation. So we are in the knowledge business and we facilitate knowledge creation. What do I mean by communities? Well, is it bad to talk about Philadelphia when you're in Pittsburgh? Or is it okay? All right. The free library of someplace east was working on expanding. They were going to double their library. And so they said, all right, we're going to double our library. We're going to every 100 years we get to build a brand new thing. They got Moshe Safdie, right? Which is, I love this phrase. The New York Times came up with Starkitect. Right? You have architects, but then you have Starkitects, you know. The people who walk in and rather than asking you what you need say, there, you'll build this. It would be magnificent. And you're like, I mean, quite literally, see this little apron thing? They had no idea how to build it. He's like, I want glass and curve. Do that. I don't know how. Anyway, so they came in and they said, well, what can we do here? Because they rolled out the blueprints for the librarian. Said, every 100 years you get this opportunity. What are we going to do with this brand new space? And the librarian said, compact shelving here. We'll move all this collection over here. And the people building this just went, we're going to build $100 million of private finance things and we're going to put in compact shelving? They said, there's got to be something more than a book temple. There's got to be something. What's the library of the future look like? We're back to the should and all this other stuff. And what we began saying is, well, if we're looking at connections and how things are connected, if we're looking at knowledge and how people develop knowledge, what we really need to talk about is let's build some interesting centers around communities. And so they picked three communities, writing, music, and entrepreneurship. And so my job was to come in and sort of work and think about these issues. So we started with the writing center. Right? Now we all know, you know, what's the writing center look like? Well, right now it's the literature section. So we sort of thought, all right, what could we do in writing? What could that be? I know. We'll do the free library press, right? We'll help all our writers, because we're about building materials and building knowledge, we'll become their publishers. And so we went to a bunch of the writing community. We said, what do you want? What do you need? Don't you really want us to become a publisher? And their answer was, we want this. We want, this is the espresso book machine. You feed it a file, it spits out a book. They want print on demand. They want all the materials in. Well, we said, well, do you want to have like an editorial board? They said, no, we're so tired of publishers turning us down. We don't want our free library to reject us. So they want everything in. And what's interesting is they not only want everything in, everyone who has a fan fiction piece and their latest novel and all this stuff in, they then wanted to remix it. They wanted the seventh grader to go in, find cool poetry being done, and then create their own poetry journal that they could distribute at their local school. They wanted to gather this kind of input. They also wanted a space, they wanted two spaces. They wanted one that was completely quiet, with tons of desks and power everywhere for their laptops. And then they wanted the other with comfortable seatings and literary magazines to be the salon. I mean, it was so stereotypical it hurts, but it makes sense, right? They wanted a place where they could write and they could hang out and talk about writing. And they wanted no editorial control, no board sitting on top of them. And their answer was, if you have a question, just email us and we'll do an informal way of governing it. We went to the music community and we said, all right, we know what the music community needs. The music community needs, you know, we know what they look like now. This is what the music collection looks like now. It's a bunch of CDs and DVDs and really good score collections and all that. But we want to do something active. So what we want is sort of a Facebook for musicians. We want to come in and help people create, you know, bands. Well, here's a drummer looking for a guitarist and all this other stuff. And they said, no. They said, first of all, that's happening already. It's called the club scene, and I don't care what you do with disco balls in the library. You ain't it, right? Unless you're going to hand out ecstasy in the youth room, you're not going to be that group. Prostitution, porn, ecstasy, it's a good day. All right. So they said, what we need is we want two grand pianos on a stage. They said, first of all, the world music and classical music world is dying. They said, there aren't a way to make a living here anymore. There's one person who will publish original scores, and you sort of have to be famous to do it. So they're perfectly willing to give away their music. Here's the score. Here's a recording of it. They need to perform it. For them, the performance is the most important thing. And in downtown Philadelphia, there wasn't enough performance space. And they wanted a place to do it. The other thing is when they talk music, L1, right now in the library, their L1 can only be expressed through humming. And they want to play. They want to say, have you thought about this? Did you think about that? Hey, well, how does this sound in this instrument? And they said, what we want is a performance. And not only that, you can record the performance, you can archive the MP3, you can podcast and distribute the hell out of it. You can put a lecture beforehand, we don't care. In fact, we love the idea that people from outside Philadelphia are going to come to hear what the Philadelphia sound is, as opposed to people coming to the Philadelphia Library to hear about music everywhere else in the world. This is going to be about our community and how we produce information. We then went to the business leaders, and we said, all right, business. Folks, we have a big reading room. We have, you know, you want to be a butcher? Here's the Butchering for Dummies books, and we have business plans. And their biggest complaints the librarians had was cookbooks, right? I'm here trying to answer a serious question on business planning, and then someone comes and asks me for Betty Crocker. Why? Because Dewey thought that cookery was part of industry. Apparently no one told librarians that Dewey classifications is not the same thing as a shelf list, but we won't go there. But the entrepreneurs said, you know, we went to these, you know, angel capitalists and big business people. We said, what can the public library do for you? And they said to us, nothing. They did. They said, nothing. We've got our own library. Then they would pause and they would say, but when I was first starting out, I was working for Company X and I had a brilliant idea. I couldn't use their resources. I couldn't use their library or they'd take the idea. So when I was a new young entrepreneur, that's what I needed. But you know what I need the library to look like? This. I need terminals to work on. I need copy space. I need a boardroom. I need a place where I can pitch to venture capitalists. I need a place where I can talk to accountants. I need to take, and this was the most brilliant idea, field trips to local successful startups. The library taking people out into the community. Which reminds me of a story. Meg Bacchus, who's a brilliant librarian at North Onondaga Public Library, she was their new adult services librarian, and she wanted to have a square dancing event, but her library was too small. So instead, what she did was she had it at an ice rink, not on the ice, down the road. She came in the next day, and all the other librarians looked and said, what was that? She was the library program. They said, no, it wasn't. It wasn't in the library. Stop that. Right? Meg's brilliant. Meg loans out her dog. She's barcoded her dog. She calls it a bark code. She's doing community gardening. She's barcoded the plots. They're talking about putting in hiking trails. She's barcoding the trails so when you search the catalog for exercise, it says, here's a book and turn left and start walking. Right? This is the kind of stuff where you reach out to the community to see what they need, not, oh, well, we do the book stuff, we do the library stuff. Right? Now, what's interesting about all of these is that not only were these centers where we would co-locate resources and services, but we would co-locate communities and people with the same problem. Right? We would have not only these centers, but we would have a curriculum working with local community colleges, local universities, international experts. When you come in to plan a business, first thing you have to develop is a business plan. They have no idea what a business plan is. You don't just say, here's a book on business plans. The British Library, National Library of Britain, took their business and industry reading room and transformed it into an entrepreneurship center. They got all their reference librarians trained as business analysts. They got them certified as business planners. They would bring them in and they would have regular meetings. They would have places to do this. My point of all of this is when you look at your community, don't look at them as monolithic readers. Look at them as people with problems and work on solving the problems. And when you look at knowledge as an active, productive, linked process, you put these together. Now, we can go one step further. They talked about creating a teen center, and they said, well, the teen center really is interfacing with all these other centers. They said, okay, we'll find different ways of connecting and moving them together. We're not going to create more silos, right? When you talk about in academic libraries have public services, and they have technical services,
Right? And public services always make so much sense in a university setting because we don't let the public in. Right? But people said, this is crazy. What we need is instructional services and research services. Because when a researcher comes in and they have a question, they may need reference services. They may need metadata and cataloging services for stuff they're producing. They may need help in building a website. They may need stuff to deposit the data. It doesn't happen front office, back office anymore. When you talk about economic development within your community, does it make sense to have reference and all this other stuff, or does it make sense to have the economic development librarian, the economic development setup? In Ann Arbor, they have production librarians. When you walk in and you have a great, brilliant idea, they have a production librarian whose job it is to work with you to develop web, video, all these resources, and then the library becomes a community publisher. A publisher of the community. The library as a place of creation, not the resting ground of the created. You know, here is the oversimplified answer, which is I do not believe in adding more stuff to the library. This needs to take the place of stuff that you're doing. Right? Librarians for too long have looked at new opportunities and looked at it as a net gain of things they have to do without a net gain of resources. Right? We need to have an honest-to-God conversation with our community to say, is this what you need to do? So the answer to how did you fund the entrepreneurium? The business community funded the entrepreneurium. Right? How do you fund the writing center? The successful author helped do that. Right? Maybe we don't do these collections of CDs anymore because we're producing CDs and materials. So every community is going to be different, but the answer is it's an ongoing negotiation with the community. One of the worst thing that what's happened in librarianship. So when I get up and I give my wonderful rousing speech, and I'm sure I'll get there today, right? People always, you know, say, oh, they don't get it. There are fewer and fewer librarians who don't get it. There are fewer and fewer librarians who sit there and say, we're in the book business. We don't do anything but catalog. There are fewer and fewer of them, right? What has happened, though, is that the progressive librarians, the people who have taken on these tasks, forgot to tell the community. So what's happened, I'll give you, I'm sorry it's an academic library example, but we could take San Francisco Public Library. When they opened up and they had less books out and the president of the library suddenly was canned because he forgot to tell people this brand new building's going to have less space for books and that's okay. In Syracuse University, we gutted all the collections of materials from the first two floors to create outdoor learning commons, places for tables and bookcases, or tables and coffee bars and places to work together. The humanities faculty went in riot. Libraries are places for books. Put more stacks there, more stacks, more stacks. What's happened is often we get it and we evolve, and then when we make those moves, our communities have not been in that loop, and they come in and they have this romantic, lovely, nostalgic view of libraries. Your library board is full of library lovers. Unfortunately, they libraries when they were nine and have not evolved. We can't allow that to happen anymore. So by going to the community and saying, we're going to not do this. We're not going to have extra hours because we want to fund this. Whatever it is, that's a discussion that we need to have with the community on a regular basis. And right now there's shouting in both directions. Libraries say, we're going to do this, and budget makers say, we're going to cut your budget. But we'll get there in a minute, right, without talking about it. Improve society, and I'm going to be real quick here. Our values cannot stop at our walls. How many people believe that patron privacy is of utmost importance? How many people believe it to the point that we should not keep records on borrowing? How many people know that if they're accessing your catalog through an internet service provider, it doesn't matter what you believe? They can recreate every screen, every keystroke, every request that they ever send to your library if they're coming through an internet service provider. If you preserve privacy within your four walls, you are not preserving privacy. Right? Do we push our patrons to the Tor network that allows them to use anonymous proxy servers? Do we teach people how to use peer-to-peer file sharing, not to pirate, but to prevent from having other people accumulate your data along the way? Do we teach them about ad blocking? Do we teach them about these kind of materials? Are we activists within the community about these issues? The other one is that service is not invisibility. Remember way back when I talked about how there are two conversants in a conversation? You're the other conversant. And that means you have a point of view. That mission that talks about to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in your community is a two-part mission. The first part is an ethical counterbalance to the second part. Facilitating knowledge within your community means that the community gets to develop whatever knowledge they want, right? The first part of that improved society says, no, there are things that we will not help facilitate knowledge in. The prostitution and porn thing, or prostitution and pie, we're okay with the pie. We're not going to help you so much on the first one, right? This idea that when someone comes in and has a conversation, you have a point of view. You have a statement to make. We need to be ready for what that view is and be active within the community to do it. Do we sit on the Chamber of Commerce? Do we sit on business development groups? Do we go to city council meetings? Do we sit and work on an active basis saying, I'm a librarian and I'm here to help and I have an idea and I have a viewpoint? And there is an obligation to lead and innovate. If we are in the knowledge business, learning and education is a change in worldview. When you learn something, you change your view of the world. Now, that can be really itty, itty bitty. Britney Spears' birthday, right? What is Jesus and what does it have to do with Glee, right? You learn this much, but it can be massive. People have come into your libraries and discovered a new career. People have come into your libraries and discovered new ideas and new books and new materials. They've discovered social action. They've discovered whole new philosophies in your library. There have been women who have come into your library and discovered how to get out of abusive situations that have saved their lives. There have been homeless that have come into your library and discovered a job to get themselves out off the street. That can be massive. If your job is about learning, your job is about change, right? You have an obligation to change. If we want to see radical improvements in our community, how can we expect radical positive improvements from the community from a staid conservative organization that doesn't change? How can we expect to bring people through our organizations to be amazing guideposts of the community, and yet we will not change? We're in the change business. We every day look to change lives. We must be willing to change ourselves. Lastly, what does it mean to be a librarian in this setting? This is the a project between the MacArthur Foundation and the Chicago Public Library. MacArthur Foundation approached, supported by the MacArthur Foundation, approached Chicago Public Library and said, youth are learning in a different way. We want to build a space where youth can learn in an interesting place. The library is an important place to do it because the library is the vaulted third space. It's not home. It's not work. It's a third trusted space. And so the librarian said, that's great. And Chicago Public literally said, here's a room about half the size, which is storage. We'll clean it out for you and it's yours. They didn't take away the stacks. They didn't take away the collection. They said, here it is. The researchers went nuts. Oh, we want this and we want this and computers and technology. We want places to sit. We want all this cool stuff. They went to the architects. They said, draw up the cool space. They took the architectural drawings. They laid them before the librarians. And the librarian's reaction was, where are the books? The researchers came to me and said, what? What was happening is that the librarians, when they looked at this space, didn't see themselves because they didn't see the tools that they use. The researchers, when they looked at this space, saw librarians everywhere. They said, you have to be there teaching and training and facilitating. You have to be making sure that people get access to resources. You're connecting and interweaving ideas. Not about the collections of books. All too often, librarians equate the value of what they do to the collections that they build. Those collections are becoming less valuable every single day. Because it is not in having the thing. It is in using the thing that it gains value. If you were in the book business, would you ever really lend a book out to someone where they could eat in front of it? How many people have a no food or drink policy in their library and check out books where they go and eat and read in the kitchen? Hello? Right? Connect these things together. My point of this is that the librarians belong in this space. They were wanted in this space, but too often, because we have a worldview around recorded knowledge, things and organizations, materials, we don't see that opportunity. So in this mission, what is a librarian? Well, first of all, a librarian is someone who understands conversations. They understand the give and take. They understand how they can facilitate them. They understand the politics of conversation. They understand the power relationships of conversation. They understand dialectics of conversation. They are facilitators. They're not people who dictate, right? In education, we've gotten past the whole sort of sage on the stage. There's a great, it's called the brick model. You guys are all empty buckets. And I am lobbing bricks of knowledge. And hopefully I hit them every so often. And if you're not awake, I give you coffee so your buckets get a little wider. Right? So we facilitate. But this still is not enough. Because if you look at this, this is a teacher. This is Google. Right? Google is in the conversation business. Not simply because they search on it. They run YouTube. They run Blogger. They are facilitating conversations like crazy. So what is it that makes us librarians? The third vital and important part of it are the values that we bring to it. We bring a value system which is unique. That decisions are made best in the richest information environments. That you have the right to access all sorts of information. That we have a job to protect you in that space. That we believe in learning. We believe in knowledge. We believe in community access. These are values that we bring to this which make us valuable. So I will finish up and then we can take some Q&A here where I started. I believe that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us. We are the right profession, uniquely positioned to lead. However, we won't get there focused on knowledge. Now, when I did this at the Pennsylvania District Library Conference where we met, I read that first bullet, the best days of librarianship are ahead of us, and the person sitting right in front of me went, poof. I've never been heckled. I think that was heckling. It's true, though. But it's not true that it's going to be made for us. It is not true that the future is guaranteed. It is not true that the best days of librarianship will simply happen on their own. People look at change in libraries and for some reason believe the fact that we've been around for 3,000 years, 2,500 years, depending on where you count, is because we haven't changed. And it's exactly the opposite. The reason we are here today is because we have gone through gut-wrenching change. We moved the collections from behind the desk to out there, but we chained them to the shelves. We pulled the chains off of them. Trust me, at some point, someone went to a meeting just like this and sat and went, a chainless library? I don't think so. We've done just fine with chains up to this point. We know how to purchase chains. Our systems are built around chains. We can catalog chains, right? It happened because people stood up and said, it's time to change. What I'm calling for when I talk about collections as secondary, when I talk about the idea of us leaving libraries and being embedded, when I talk about focusing on knowledge and materials, is not something new. It's actually very, very old. It goes all the way back to the Library of Alexandria. You are not curators of a collection. You are not handlers of materials. You certainly are not stewards of recorded knowledge. You're change agents. You're educators. You're stewards of a community. Your collection lives in the homes and apartments and businesses that surround your library, not what's in it. Right? So, when I say that the best days of librarianship are ahead of us, in the darkest nights, the stars shine bright. And these are dark days. Budget cuts, right? When we look at layoffs for librarians, when we look at people questioning our future, when we look at this, these are dark days. I had my students go and do a study on what is the state of library funding, and they all came back and said, it's not good. But all of them found this, that in these darkest nights, In the days when knowledge has become a commodity, in the days when intellectual has become synonymous with elite and not positively looked at, in these days of contention, in these days of economic strife, our community stood up for us. When called upon, they stood up. When libraries closed, they took to the streets. When libraries were proposed to close, they threatened. They said, "You will not do this." That in these darkest days, our communities stood up when called. When a Barnes & Noble closes, it's not the collection, because when a Barnes & Noble closes, they don't picket. When Blockbuster closes, people don't riot in the streets. When a Starbucks closes, people don't go, "No, you can't take our Starbucks." But when a library closes, people go, "No, we will not allow this to happen." They were there. They were participants. When we needed them, they came. And yes, they could come stronger. And yes, it did not solve all the problems. But we need to return the value. What they stood up for, what they donate their allowance for, is not the books and materials and ivy. It's you. You are the folks that endure. Over time, our books, our DVDs will become our 8-track tapes, will become our scrolls and tablets before them. We will remain. E-books may replace the novel, right? Who cares? These are just tools. We are the value. We are the ones who, when we look to the future, we remain. But we won't remain if we hide behind our stacks, because soon we will find those are not safe places at all. Those are the places that people will stop looking for us. We need to be in their homes and in their issues.